You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and I'm Eric Clay, your host, and our guest today is Roger Smith. Roger, it's good to have you.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Eric. Great to be here.
And as we do with each of these shows, can you start us with a little bit of a thumbnail sketch or a mosaic, you know, the major pieces that are the mosaic of your life, so that we get a jumping point? I know these are questions that people just grimace at, and yes, but they let us start from scratch.
Starting from scratch. Yeah. Yes. Okay.
Invent yourself on air.
Well, I guess if given the chance, I like to think of myself or identify myself as a little glimmer of brilliant, illuminated consciousness currently disguised as a human being, mm-hmm. you know, as all of us are, I suppose. But I presume you probably want something a little more personal.
Actually, I mean... it's who are you, not necessarily what you do. So that's actually at 30,000 feet.
Yes,
that
okay.
Works.
All
and
right.
As we come closer down, what else
say? Tat dvam asi, that thou art. But, all right, so I'm an Ithacan, I suppose. I've lived here for about a decade after being born and raised in Brooklyn. And I am a father of a weird and wonderful 12-year-old daughter mm-hmm. who's just finished her first year at the Layman Alternative Community School and loving it. I have worked as a teacher, a activist organizer, and currently working as a freelance writer. Mm-hmm. I also have a program on WRFI, which is how we met. Mm-hmm. It's called Crazy Words, Crazy Tune. It airs on Wednesdays from 7 to 9 p.m. Listeners, please tune in. And it concentrates on the music of the 1920s and 1930s. That's my little niche. I have a personal love of the popular culture of that mm-hmm. era. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a start.
Yeah, yes, that is. And we're going to start with a song that you play on your show, or that you've played on your show.
Oh, yes. Well, I don't know if I actually have played that show. Let me introduce that for a second.
Yeah.
Since we're on, this is... if you look on the WRFI webpage under the host profiles, I know you, Eric, have a profile of yourself and mm-hmm. your own show, and I have one too.
Yeah.
And it says that I got into this music when I was, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old. There was a fellow who was courting my older sister. He didn't court her very successfully, but one of his methods was supplying her with a mixtape. And I just appropriated this mixtape because he was an old jazz guy and it had incredible stuff on it. So this is a song from 1923. I should apologize to the people who have some vocal difficulties because it's called You Tell Her I Stutter. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. It just, you know, brilliantly captures early jazz.
Right. Okay. And so we go.
Thank you. 'cause I stutter and always get in the. She ought to know I've a bungalow where we two can raise a little eef-a-sop-a-lop-a. Help the feller and go and tell her I bought the ring and stud. I'm thinking of her, 'cause I love her. So you tell her, oh you tell her, 'cause I stutter too
much. And that was You Tell Her I Stutter by the Cotton Pickers.
It's and Phil Napoleon and I believe Miff Mole, and the vocal was by Billy Jones, who was part of a vaudeville-style duo called the Happiness Boys.
That's great. You were describing your show and how where that came from. How did you make your way from Brooklyn? I mean, this is like little New York in some ways. This is the Little Apple, because our demographics here in some ways very closely represent New York, but more likely actually we're closer to Nassau County than we are to the New York City proper because of the lack of minorities in this county.
Well, maybe by a certain way of looking at demographics.
Actually, by several ways of looking at demographics, including some of the disparities and the people who can't afford to live, because it's an interesting place to be. So,
for
what
sure.
brought you from Brooklyn to Ithaca?
That's a good question. Well, I would say one thing was my lifelong desire to live in a smaller but still urban environment. Mm-hmm. After growing up in Brooklyn, and I spent some of my 20s living in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I tell people that it was only when I was in my 20s that I really understood that I lived on planet Earth, you know, because growing up in Brooklyn, I suppose I was near Prospect Park, but still it wasn't that great an experience of nature. I didn't understand that. I thought life consisted of these, you know, rectangles of square blocks.
Right.
So I had that desire in me for a long time. And when Magda was born and in her first year of life, her mother and I were contemplating leaving the city and living in an intentional community.
Mm-hmm.
So we visited several in different parts of the country, including spending a month at the Eco Village here in Ithaca, and that was a very, you know, rich experience. That 1 month, it was enough to show us that we probably were not cut out for the intentional community lifestyle,
right,
as a family,
right,
but that we did love Ithaca.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
We'd spend our afternoons walking around Fall Creek, and I grew up in a part of Brooklyn that is an upper middle class neighborhood that's leafy with Victorian houses. They call it the Ditmas Park yes. neighborhood now. So I felt, you know, sort of viscerally at home in Fall Creek, and we ended up moving there.
Right. The houses are a little bit smaller, not as affluent, but there is a feel of being in an urban area. And you identified this as a smaller urban area. And a lot of people who come to Ithaca don't, especially if they come from a major metropolitan area. They tend to see it as a small town or even as a rural place. And that, you know, that just misses so much of what goes on here.
Especially if you come from Eco Village down the hill from that part of 79,
yes,
you're
yes,
looking
yes.
at, you know, Cornell, which really looks like a metropolis. And
right. And
it is another city, and it's part of the city,
yeah, yeah,
so
yeah,
we
yeah.
need to
That's
think
right.
of it
That's
as
right.
as part of what makes this place what it is. So, but compared to an urban area, you know, what Ithaca has and what I've always valued is the what I consider a really cunning balance of nature and culture.
You know,
there's very strong culture here, very amazing people doing amazing things. I never tire of meeting people here.
Right.
Yet, you know, nature is so accessible.
We are an interesting we are a place of interesting contradictions. We have the highest number of people who can walk to work of a small city in the U.S. that was recently published. We also have the highest number of people who commute in from outside the metro area to work from outside the county, and second only to New York City and New York State.
Wow!
And we live on opposite poles. And most of our working class folks can't afford to live here, so all of those percentages of those people in our population have actually, and I would consider myself, like, income wise I am, but most do not live in the county because they cannot afford to.
Right.
We're so about 10,000. I mean, we have 20,000 people who commute in to work from outside the county on a workforce of permanent non-student workers of about 60,000. And that's
right, and the rental market is so
right, and it's
so
hot
very
and
tight and
yeah,
difficult.
Yeah. So we're an interesting place, and as on this show we do, we get to know each other, and we get to know the place. And you're the first person who ever described Ithaca as a cunning balance of nature and culture. I mean, or I'm not sure if I got the words exactly right, but close. And that's
I'm not the first person who's had the idea.
No. But the operative there is cunning. Balance, because there is this intentional, and we all do. The people who've gotten lost in the cunning balance are the lower income working groups, and they've gotten lost, and they're the ones who have, for the most part, who have to commute in from outside the county. But
right.
But in terms of being able to balance in a sophisticated way, we try to do a lot. There's some more stuff that we could try to do. That could make a real difference, and still not lose the environment, the, you know, open access to the environment,
right? So, and you know, the food shed,
I think,
you know, there's the movement here around food and agriculture, is one of the most exciting things about it,
right? And it has yet to also that tends also to be a more affluent interest and affordability, although there are some things that have been done to try to address that. But on a larger scale, the issue with the food is going to be affordability.
Yes,
and,
for sure.
And
I'm not sure I can sustainably afford to eat and feed my family the way I wish to. But
right, yeah.
But make the effort to do so.
Right, but you can also sample it here, and there are places, while it's becoming more popular all around the country, you can sample it here earlier in many
right.
ways.
Yeah, which right, is deep, and we've which been... members of two different community-supported agriculture farm shares, and gotten help from the Healthy Food for All movement. So, we're definitely on the working class end of the scale, income-wise,
right?
But able to make a go of
it. Yeah. And also, people are consciously, one of the things, you may not have chosen to be in an intentional community, but you intentionally picked the community where you are. And there are many people who move to Ithaca or choose to stay on here with that kind of intentionality. And so they're balancing things. They're paying more in housing costs than they might in other places. They're paying more for food, but they're also they're picking the lifestyle that they live in a conscious way.
I've always believed that that Ithaca, compared to so many places in the USA, you know, retains a sort of core functioning community.
Let's play another track. You brought with you a piece of music by World Entertainment War.
Well, some of you may know the astrologer Rob Bresny, who has the Free Will Astrology column. I think it's in the Village Voice. I first found him in the San Francisco Bay Guardian or something like that, and he's also a musician. I love this track because one of my interests is the mass media. I got an MA in media ecology from New York University and was a media activist in the early 1990s. So I love the sort of sophisticated critique of television in this song called Televisionary.
Cool. So we're going to play it.
Don't kill your television yet. Have another cigarette.
In your imagination.
Tiger, tiger, burning bright. Take back the airwaves of the night.
In your imagination.
The world is young, your soul is free. So set the television free.
In your imagination.
Televisionary, and performed by World Entertainment War.
Yes, they failed to get very big after a promising start and after getting signed by Bill Graham in the early 90s.
Uh-huh. So you did a media degree at NYU?
Yes, that's right.
And you bring a kind of a critical sensibility to what we hear and what we know and what we...
In college, I was an English major, and I minored in political science and religion.
Uh-huh.
And always wanted to find the politics in media and literature.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Wishing that there was a film and media major at my college, which they instituted, you know, a few years after I graduated.
Right, right.
In 1990, I moved out to San Francisco and was very affected by the first Gulf War mm-hmm. of 91, Gulf War I. Got involved in the anti-war movement. I had done an internship with the group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting,
mm-hmm.
One of the first groups in the media reform movement, focusing on journalism and the political biases in the news media. There were people very concerned about the propagandistic pro-war media coverage of mm-hmm. the Gulf War. So I spent a couple of years really as a freelance gadfly activist mm-hmm. in San Francisco. Finally decided I wanted to learn more about, the history and the political economic structure of the media. Considered teaching about media, mm-hmm. media literacy, that sort of thing. So I ended up moving back to my hometown and getting that degree. I was attracted by a scholar there named Neil Postman, pretty well-known social commentator,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
author of Amusing Ourselves to Death.
Uh-huh. That's quite
public,
a title.
Public Discourse in the Age of Show Business.
Yes. Yes, and amusing ourselves to irrelevance.
Yes, exactly. You know, and he had the brilliant idea, following on the theories of Marshall McLuhan and Harold Innes, that the form, the medium is the message.
Right.
The form of media introduced into a culture changes not just how we communicate, but also how we think, how we interact, what we believe, the epistemological structures
yes.
of individuals and society.
Yep.
And so the ironic thing is that I got my degree in 1994, doing as my thesis a long 300-year sociological history of the U.S. media. And then the year after that, another revolutionary medium was plopped into the world culture, namely the internet.
Right, right. What I'm curious about is what experiences made this stance, this kind of critical one-off stance, so appealing to you? What about your life kind of shaped your character or built on the material that you started with to kind of focus you in that direction?
Yeah, you really go for the jugular with these questions, don't you?
Well, we do. This is one of the things about this show is that we try to model getting to know each other fairly deeply, fairly quickly, but politely. And if I do go for the jugular, then I know you're teasing me on that to some extent. But if I do then some guests have said that's not really a question I want to deal with either off air or on air, and that's something I'm perfectly open to.
No.
I know you're teasing me, but I also want listeners to hear that, because that's the commitment on the show, is that we model a kind of a way to get to know each other quickly. Like, I didn't read your post on the WRFI site. I do no background research on guests.
Because
unless I happen to already know them, but I don't do any further research, because the process is, well, the medium and the message. This is another version of that.
Okay.
And this is how we get to know each other, and I can't fake it. If I fake it, then it's not going to happen. It's not going to be real.
That's lovely.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I guess that I got a very, very powerful education.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I went to Hunter High School in Manhattan, one of the specialized high school for the brainiacs.
And Townsend Harris used to be the one for men, and Hunter was the one for women, and then
that's
they
right.
went for co-ed.
They went co-ed, I think, in the early 80s, yeah, and yeah. I graduated in 85 and went to Swarthmore College.
Another brainiac school?
Yes. In fact, I just returned there for the first time in decades for my 25th reunion, mm-hmm. And, you know, geez, what a bunch of overachievers. So I was chatting with many doctors, lawyers, tenured professors, you know, people who had really succeeded in many walks of life. But I guess the other element in Swarthmore's brand, you know, was founded by Quakers in 1864. This was its 150th anniversary. So the feeling was incorporating social values into the life of the mind and into one's livelihood. And so everybody was even though they were so successful, they had found ways to really live out good values. And so I suppose by the time I graduated from there, I had been fairly politicized.
Mm-hmm.
And so I moved across the country. My sister was living in San Francisco. I found a room in a house full of Earth First activists.
Uh-huh.
You know, fit in perfectly well with them, and was, you know, very interested in pursuing political activism, whether I could find a way to do that for pay or not.
Right.
And that, I guess, was the career trajectory that I was on at that time in my 20s.
Mm-hmm. What did it mean to you to become politicized? I mean, what was it? Where were you to begin with, and how did that change happen?
Well, we're talking about the George H.W. Bush presidency.
Yep. Bush won.
Yes. And, well, I mean, you were asking about my interest in you know, progressive critique of the media, I guess that fused my political and my intellectual, you know, those elements of myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like I was able to, you know, read between the lines, find the alternative stories that, you know, were either suppressed or the you know, false stories that were being sold, and, you know, related it to the news media as an industry, you know, in the core of our military-industrial complex. You know, it's been quite a while since I was been talking that line, but
at
the time I was very into it,
right,
you know,
right,
and became a spokesperson.
Right. And our lives are these funny mixes of things that we've picked up at various points and, you know, learned them, lived them, and then moved on in slightly different ways to other things.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I grew up, you know, you hear the incredible statistics about the role of television in the lives of, you know, children mm-hmm. and Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the amount of television consumed has decreased a little bit as, you know, as other screens have become enticing. But back then, this was the age of the, you know, the three networks. Television was dominant, and I watched a lot of television growing up. And I gradually came to, you know, really, it really bothered me that advertising, you know, what is actually going on when an advertisement runs on a TV station,
mm-hmm.
you know, a company that wants to advertise its products makes a purchase from a network or a media supplier. The thing that is being sold, you know, could be considered airtime on the station.
Mm-hmm.
But really, if you're in the business, and my father was in the advertising business for 15 years or so, you know, the commodity that's manufactured for sale that the company mm-hmm. buys is the audience.
Right.
Is you and me.
Right.
You know? So we're
and whatever degree of attention they can get from you.
Yeah, and I just have never been able to really tease out the, you know, the political and social implications of how media audiences are situated in that transaction, where something, you know, we're incorporated into this mass audience for, say, you know, a sitcom or a, you know, an entertainment program, but we're, you know, we're not an agent in that transaction. We're just the thing sold, you know, like, well, like chattel, and we have history of selling human beings.
The, yeah, and well, this story may be slightly off topic, but it gets at back in the late 80s, early 90s, they were having trouble. This was before SUVs and vans became more similar in design. And they were trying to figure out what were the predictors that would define whether a person would buy an SUV or a minivan. And they only they did tons and tons of research, and they only came up with two variables that had any significant differences in the two groups. The SUV buyers were less happy in their marriages, and the and the minivan buyers were more community oriented. They tended to carry more people with them.
Right, and those
were the two variables, and because demographically, income, race, all those other things, they were just a wash in terms of and professions. They were just none of them pointed out, but those two. But
right, right. So those are two different you know, niche psychographics
that
they were able to target.
Right, but they
this stuff just infuriates me. It still does.
Yeah. good. So what shall we go to, Jarabi?
Certainly.
Sure.
I love listening to this music.
And this will be an instrumental break. Do you want to say a bit about it?
Tumani Diabate. This music is just like my favorite music in the world. It's heaven to the ears.
Thank you.
the kora of Toumani Diabaté from Mali, from his very first album, which I still think is his best.
And we continue to add regions, or not regions of the world, but we add countries where music comes from. I've probably got music on the show at this point from 50 or 60 different countries in about 30 different languages.
Well, the music of Mali is incredibly rich and has really found its way into the world music, the commercial niche.
Right. And if I am correct, I'm not sure. Let me just think about this. I believe it's Mali. No, it's not Mali. It's one of the. It's a nearby country. They have one of their national symbols is an antelope, but the antelope is extinct in that area. But it's a reference to, if I've got the story right, it's a reference to a practice animism was the word that Westerners used to refer to, but it's basically a worship of the spirits and nature and the ancestors all rolled up into one. And that it's the only country, if I've got my facts straight, in the world that self-identifies as that is the national religion.
And beautiful.
Yeah, it's a can't powerful, help you. And it's a powerful. But this music evokes that kind of quality of connection and play back and forth and the lightness and this particular piece is just incredibly powerful.
It's lovely.
Yeah. So, one of the things that I like to do as a way to kind of get people to know each other is to talk about change. Because many of the thing who we are is oftentimes visible in the trajectories that have changed over time. And so what I'm wondering is how, as you have lived and kind of pursued your career and you're being a father and a partner and all this other stuff, how have you changed as a person? You know, what about life has turned out to be other or somehow different than you thought it would be? And how have you not changed? How have you kind of deepened in you can take whichever one of those you want as a starting point?
I think I really haven't changed all that much.
Mm-hmm.
I pride myself on still looking 25. But when people ask me, as they always do, what's your secret of eternal youth? I usually say, don't decide what you want to be when you grow up. And I have not decided. I'm in fact still struggling with the issue of right livelihood, mm-hmm. and of making a living.
Mm-hmm.
Although I suppose, growing older and parenthood have made me take the topic much more seriously.
Right.
And
making a living is not the main thing we do with our lives, but it is an essential thing.
Yes. Both my father and my mother managed to have very successful careers by pursuing work that they loved.
Mm-hmm,
my father eventually switched from advertising to fiction writing and got six children's books and five novels published.
Wow.
And had a whale of a time doing it. My mother began as a secretary in a literary agency, and 30 years later, she was running the place. Very fulfilling career. And they instilled in me the idea that the pinnacle of happiness in life would be finding and doing work that you loved.
Right.
So during the years I described in my 20s, when I was wanting to, do politics for a living, I was pursuing that, and I eventually did find work in the. I worked for the at the United Nations for 5 years, doing NGO network organizing, but I suppose that was not really my path.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm doing this freelance writing that may. You have to really make a circuitous argument to find it being a strong contribution, but I don't think I'm harming anybody.
Right, you know? Right,
and
right,
I'm
right,
pulling
right.
down a living.
Right, right, and I also get the sense that you know when anyone lives in the shadow of people who have done something so very well, it's always kind of hard to find your footing. You know, because they set the bar really high for you.
For sure.
And that's you know.
Yes, and as I only recently came to understand, the most productive years of my parents' careers happened to coincide with the strongest economy that the world has ever known. Not to take anything away from their success,
which was
monumental.
Right. And that always, yes, yes, you have said it very well. Yeah.
My parents also remained married for 44 years until my mother passed away in 1998. And so I, you know, internalized a very strong idea about marriage. And I suppose one change I've had to face recently is the breakup of my marriage, mm-hmm. which, so that's a significant change because it was a real struggle for me to arrive at the idea that that we could separate, that it was thinkable,
right?
You know,
right.
And then that it was even desirable,
right? You know? Right. It is an extraordinary change. Is an extraordinarily painful process, even if it's monumentally slow.
Right.
Yeah.
You know. Also, though, I have found recently that there's been a lot of positive change that has been catalyzed or mm-hmm. mobilized mm-hmm. as mm-hmm. a result of that decision,
mm-hmm.
And that's new and welcome.
Right, 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 right. It presents dangers and opportunities.
Yes.
Yeah.
For the first decade that I lived here, you know, arriving here with a toddler, most of the people I met were fellow parents. Parents of my daughter's peers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's only been in, say, the last 6 months since moving from married to separated and then attempting to trod the path between separated and single,
right.
That I've met many new people and made new friends who are not parents,
right,
you know, and
right.
widened my social circle.
Yes, yes, yes. And for me, I began to meet people. Yeah, the biggest surprise for me, and I'm twice divorced. I didn't learn the first time.
Twice so. Blessed.
Right. But I began to meet people who don't have children, women who don't have children, and began to see a whole different set of relationships that were possible than in my other relationships. And it has been a sobering and it's been a good thing, but it's not been an easy thing.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is a good thing to see different different ways of adulthood,
and being able to see yourself. As a pastor, I used to describe death of a partner as feeling half of yourself was cut off in that moment, and you're just the uncauterized bleeding self. And divorce feels much the same way, especially when it's unwelcome or unanticipated or not processed, or even if you choose it, it feels that way.
Yet at the same time, you know, you allow a partner to, you know, feel like half of yourself.
Right, exactly.
You know, with the expectation that you know, she'll take you in that way.
Right, and it's not, but it's, and it's not even about having an unhealthy or codependent relationship. It's just when you collaborate so much, you over the course of the day, that's how things become. You see life in that way.
Yes, exactly.
And one of the issues that I think we have come to as a culture with putting such emphasis on the nuclear family, and this has come up several times in the last few weeks, is that no culture in history was organized around the nuclear family. They were organized
around to the exclusion of community other
other forms.
Family.
That's what I mean. That's the more extended family, clan, 30 to 70 people in your life kind of numbers. That's the way most cultures for most of history have organized. And the West has been able to do it because we were so affluent. This gets back to your comments on your parents' time. Because we had so much money, we could substitute with money many of the relationships we would have had to get things done in our lives and do things for others. And we don't know how to do it. And as we face a decline,
and it shouldn't be done because we have destroyed or weakened these other resources that sustain.
We destroy the environment, yeah. Right. And so sustainability in the long run is going to be the rediscovery of community. And we think about the technology of saving energy, but it's more the relationship building. And part of why this show matters to me is that as we learn to know each other quickly and to know how we suffered and how we've thrived and what we've aspired to and not achieved, as well as what we've achieved, we get to know each other much more closely. And we begin to have an ability to work together quickly, that if we don't find these ways to quickly come together across our differences and use them to our advantage, we're not going to be able to make it. That's my kind of gut feeling.
Yeah, it sounds good, man.
So you brought up music that the title to this actually just, you know, Life is Sweet and Afterlife, these two cuts.
Yeah, it's really one song. And yes, it's beautiful. You know, just on the subject of how you know, there is pain in life, but beauty to be found even in that pain. Yeah, this is like my favorite song in the world.
Okay, here we go.
This one is for the girl who says she's unlucky in love. You deserve to have the world at your feet. And if one person, one man could be enough, then I wish it could be me. I wish it could be me. This one is for the boy whose daddy never had time for him. I wish I could build you a little house for you to hide in. I'd give you back your summers. I'd give you back all your summers. You still have summers. Life is sweet, life is sweet, life is sweet. Bittersweet, and the days keep rolling along. This one is for the girl who says those voices in her head never leave her alone. Don't listen to your teacher. You're not crazy, you're just smarter than the rest of them. Paint a picture, write a song, tell your story, bang a gong. Life is sweet, life is sweet, life is sweet. Bittersweet, and the days keep rolling. This one is for the boy who's not allowed to be roses, I think you're beautiful. And you meet a girl, you fall in love, and it doesn't work out. It won't be the first time. They don't make a cure for that. So you eat your breakfast, read a book, open up your window, be alone. Life is sweet, life is sweet, life is sweet. Bittersweet, and the days keep rolling along.
First heard that song in the mid-90s, once on the radio on WFMU, and it stayed with me for weeks and weeks, and I never heard it again, but then I thought of it years later. I just thought of the song, and then that's when I remembered, we have the internet. I could look it up and find it, and I did. Maria McKee. Man, I love that song.
That's really... beautiful song, beautiful, beautiful interlude of healing music. Now, one of the things that I end the show with, and our guest this hour on the Made of Clay Report has been Roger Smith, and thank you for being with us.
Pleasure.
What I try to get people to do, because I think we have a lot to learn from each other, what are the things that you do to kind of to sustain yourself, to keep yourself going, to even your inner life, your emotion, your mind, your body, to kind of keep things fit and working, and for play, yeah.
Well, why don't I talk about what I did yesterday? I know you have a divinity background, and so I told you that my own religious description is Jewish, Taoist, pagan. You know, Jewish only by ethnicity, really. I grew up in a non-practicing Jewish household. Discovered the Taoist philosophy when I was studying religion in college. But to the extent that I have a practice of spirituality, it's of the pagan type. Last night I attended a summer solstice gathering. There were several dozen of us out at a farm in Lansing, and it was a beautiful event. So, and I've been involved in helping to plan these events for the solstices and the equinoxes and the moments, mm-hmm. the pagan holidays that fall in between the solstices and the equinoxes, such as May Day was the last one, mm-hmm. or Beltane. It was a beautiful gathering and really quite sustaining and healing. And I really follow and gain a lot of wisdom from just knowing where we are in the solar cycle, you know, it's the agrarian cycle. I call it the romance of the sun and the earth.
Wow.
So, you know, at this moment, solstice was yesterday morning at 6:51 a.m. You know, it's the time of maximum light, you know, so the longest day. And in that long, high arc of light, I feel like, you know, all is exposed. All can be perceived, you know. And so it's a time to take stock of everything going on and everything changing. But at the same time, what's worthy about solstice is that it's the beginning of the growing darkness, which will continue to grow until the winter solstice.
Right. And we won't perceive the growing darkness for a few days yet.
And we have such a cultural prejudice, you know, in favor of light and against darkness, you know, not just politically, racially, but also morally and spiritually. And I find that, you know, well, like the song says, we should, the life is bittersweet and we have to embrace that and welcome it and honor it.
I guess historically we've had a much more balanced view, but in the last 200 years, and with the notion of pumping people up and selling stuff, we have lost, because in the texts, in the ancient texts, there's a strong, powerful balance, you know.
Sure. I think of Ecclesiastes.
But we have tended to lose sight of any sense of balance as we've run on a trajectory of self-indulgence, global, individually and nationally and culturally or even religiously.
Keep on the sunny side. Always on the sunny side, right?
Yes.
As though there's something wrong with us if we, if we feel down, you know, or if something, if we lose someone. But this is part of life. Death is part of life.
And our capacity for joy is proportional to our capacity for sorrow.
Exactly.
And that's one of the kind of spiritual disciplines or facts. What do you do on a daily basis or weekly basis to kind of keep yourself aware of a balance in these things?
Well, I try to stay highly exuberant, and I carry around my sacred object, which I will give you a sample of now. Sacred now.
Would that be a penny whistle? No.
I don't know what you call this. This is a toy whistle.
Yes.
And I spend time with my daughter, you know, and I've been exercising more in the last year than ever in my life. Is very helpful. And I read.
That's good. All of those things are good. And I think it's important that we talk about them because be conscious that this is what we do to maintain our sense of place whole and wholeness in each other's lives.
Yeah. And I talk to friends and write to friends. I have some wonderful deep correspondences with friends on email. And, I sort of miss handwriting letters and stamps and all of that. But on the other hand, you know, now I have these long word processing files and I can go back and read what I wrote, not just, I got back.
Yeah, you get it both ways. That's right. Got to save the programming, though, to make sure that you can access it.
Yes.
The computer program.
And back up.
Yes. Well, our guest has been Roger Smith. Roger, it's really been lovely to get to know you.
The same, sir. Thank you so much for the invitation.
And we're going to close this program with playing some music from Hairspray. Come So Far, Got So Far to Go.
Totally.
Yeah.